Shop the Sherwin-Williams Winter Sale and get 30% off paints and stains January 9th through the 19th. Whether you're refreshing your interior or exterior, we've got the colors to bring your vision to life. And with delivery, getting everything to your door is easier than ever. Shop online or visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details. Delivery available on qualifying orders.
Cosmic storm, floating on whimsical wavelengths is the norm. Dancing through the stars, chasing spectrums of light, riding the waves that are just out of sight.
Ice cream, you scream, we all scream for ice cream. Time for some sweet, delicious science delivered right here on Whimsical Wavelengths. Food science. I love the breadth of what we get to explore here on the podcast. This discussion is going to investigate some of the science that goes into perfecting and understanding the greatest frozen dessert of all time. And it comes in so many different flavors. Yeah, ice cream. We're taking another trip into food science. Our first whimsical foray into this discipline was with Dr. Brian Lee, and talking all about Unami in season one. For this expedition into the sweet and creamy, what needs to be set up? On one hand, there is nothing I need to set up because nearly all of us have had ice cream, or at the very least something similar without dairy. On the other, have you ever tried to make it at home? It works with the basic stuff you have at home, but it just isn't the same. It's not fluffy, it's missing a je ne sais quoi. There's a lot that goes into the producing of ice cream that's bought at the local store. And this is what we'll explore in just a moment. There are some terms I'll introduce here and now, and we'll see if they're exactly the same. What I mean is, in the readings I came across some terms, jargon, concepts, well, stuff that I'd be quite comfortable using with respect to volcanoes. This is not a joke. Liquid rock and ice cream seem to have a few things in common. First, both are complex mixes of different phases. Magma can have crystals of different sizes and shapes, different gas phases like water and carbon dioxide and sulfur dioxide, as well as the liquid component. Ice cream, on the other hand, is a mix of ice crystals, fat, air, proteins, and liquid components that are in solution with sugars and the like. They just don't crystallize. How these materials move, melt, freeze, etc., it's all complex and depends on the structures within the material. In past episodes, I've talked about eruption dynamics and how viscosity, or resistance to flow, changes with eruption style. Well, viscosity, or more broadly, rheology, how a substance flows under a force over time, is important here too. There's other terms that I came across, like glass transition temperature. In volcanology, it's the temperature of the lava or magma when it solidifies into a glass or a solid without internal structure. So this term also applies to ice cream. The crossover between scientific disciplines is real. So be ready to chill here on Whimsical Wavelengths as we scoop into the coolest science around. This week's guest is no soft serve when it comes to sweet science, so grab your spoons and prepare for brain freeze. So our guest today got her PhD at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, where she studied how fat networks within dairy foods like ice cream can alter sensorial and rheological properties. Today she applies that science background as an industry consultant and science communicator. Dr. Abigail Thayil, thank you for being here today on Whimsical Wavelengths.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
So perhaps before beginning down the path of science, you're the second food scientist who's come on the podcast, which is, first of all, amazing. Mm-hmm. As I didn't even know it was like a separate stream of something you could do until Dr. Brian Lee came on. So how did you discover the path?
Yeah, so I feel like most people, food science, I didn't grow up wanting to be a food scientist. I also had no idea, you know, that food science was even a career. I grew up in Wisconsin and ended up going to the University of Wisconsin-Madison because that was like the good school that you should go to. And I started in the School of Engineering, but pretty quickly realized that's what my parents really wanted, not what I was really going to enjoy. So I kind of early on had this moment of panic where I was like just searching, like just looking at the entire list of science majors at UW because I knew I wanted to do something science. And that is the first time I saw food science. Like I already was at college and I was like, this can't be real. Like what science would there be behind food? And I actually called one of my older sisters and like read her like the short list of majors I thought I could be interested in. And when I mentioned food science, she had actually just taken a food science class because she was majoring in dietetics. And she was like, wait, Abby, that could like actually be perfect for you. You should like further investigate this. So it was kind of by some good luck that I found food science.
Yeah, I guess there isn't any thing out there that kind of directs anybody towards that until you get to university. Hey?
Right. No. Which I think is really sad because after that, I met with a professor just to like learn more, like what is food science? Like what careers would you possibly have? And like immediately I was very sold on it because it's like a mixture of all my favorite sciences because you do like chemistry and biology and microbiology and physics, but you do it all sort of like the application is food, right? It's not like you learn about like random forces in physics anymore. It's all like very, at least it was very interesting to me because it's like, well, how can we get apples that are the right ripeness in the grocery store at the right time? Like it was so applicable.
I bet. And physics only becomes random forces when you get into quantum mechanics, right?
Right.
Okay, terrible joke. But today we are planning to learn about ice cream, which is exciting. I mean, who doesn't like ice cream? But getting ready and trying to get this all going, I was like, where do I even start? And so I thought, let's start somewhere really, really silly because everyone knows what ice cream is. But maybe, just maybe, there's a different scientific definition than what I'm expecting.
Yeah, so it's funny because, you know, if you study like ice cream like I did, there are actually textbooks on this. Like, and so we would always joke when I was getting my master's and PhD, like ice cream is a complex food made up of this, this, and this. So what most people don't realize about food is like it's made up of smaller components. So for ice cream, we would say it's a mixture of an unfrozen serum phase, and that holds like your salts, your minerals, some of the protein. So that doesn't freeze, like not all of the water freezes in ice cream. Then you have fat globules. Then you have fat globules that form a larger fat network. And we actually call this like a partially coalesced network. It's like a specific structure. And then these fat networks and some of the protein surround air bubbles or air cells. So it might sound crazy that, yeah, I studied ice cream for my PhD, but it's actually a really complex food because you have so many different phases. Like you have a water phase, a fat phase, and air. And to stabilize that all, you know, to stay in a freezer for months without changing is actually quite a feat.
I think instantaneously I know all the words you just used except for serum. I feel like that one has a separate definition.
Yes, I would just say it's like the solution or the water phase of ice cream and it dissolves certain things. It dissolves like the salt or the lactose or some of the other sugars and some of the protein. So it's just like a watery phase with certain things in it.
Okay, so it's liquid in other words.
Yes.
Okay. Well, normally when I go down this road with a guest, I have a couple of papers. I mean, you did give me some, what you call them, review papers something like that. And I used the paper summary to help us get to a final conclusion for the show. Instead, I thought here today we could use a hypothetical goal of designing the perfect ice cream for a new fictional shop. We'll call it a whack of whimsical ice cream. There's a lot of properties to look at here. One of the more fascinating ones that I quickly found was melting. Like, there's a way to measure melting. So how does melting affect what kind of ice cream we get?
Yes, melting is very interesting to me because you can manipulate it. So there's a couple ways you could change your ice cream formulation to have it melt slower or faster. And some of those are adding, if you look at like an ingredient statement of ice cream, you might see gums like guar gum or xanthan gum or carrageenan. And those are really big molecules that sort of thicken or add viscosity to the ice cream so that even if the water does melt, it's actually so thick still, it doesn't like collapse. So that's one way you slow melting. And then a second way is actually you change like the fat phase. So in milk or cream, you have just free fat globules like floating around. But in ice cream, you actually want to make those fat globules run into each other and sort of partially merge or partially coalesce to form this like large fat network of millions of tiny fat globules. And if that fat network forms, it's actually quite strong. It sort of can hold up the ice cream structure so that it doesn't collapse as well. And I would say those are the two main ways we control melting. But also, if you want to talk about like products that are in the store, I feel like every summer there's a news story about, like, do you know, like the ice cream sandwiches, like with the chocolate cookies and the ice cream in the center? So these
don't melt, right? And
yes,
then everyone's complaining
exactly,
about
yes,
that. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, so there's always some news story that's like, well, I put this ice cream sandwich in the sun all day and it never melted. But I mean, what happens is it did melt. There's nothing stopping the ice turning into water. Absolutely, the ice turned into water. The structure just didn't collapse because it's has a lot of those thickeners added. So it's just the ice cream was formulated in such a way that it kind of can keep its structure even once the water melts.
Okay, but what, I guess I got two questions. Let's start with the easier one first, the harder one, I guess. So these different ways of melting, how does that change like how we interact with it? Like taste-wise, like I can imagine making it very viscous when it melts. Might still be good when it's cold, but as it gets warm, it probably gets pretty gross.
So I would say most of these types of formulation changes, they're not done to impact our taste. Oftentimes for they'll be done for ice cream sandwiches. You want it to be a little more thick or viscous just for manufacturing purposes because you're making these sandwiches so fast and like cutting off the ice cream so fast. You make it so that it's more easy to manufacture. So it's not, it doesn't really impact our taste that much actually. Or you might do it because like I have little nieces and nephews and when they eat like an ice cream cone, it's often like a complete disaster of a mess where it's like, why is this melting so fast? So it's not, I haven't seen much where it impacts our taste or kind of flavor perception. Often it's for some other reason we would make a formulation like this.
It doesn't change the texture though in the mouth? That was more where I was going than taste.
So it can in, it probably does, but maybe not enough that we often notice it. I know there is some studies that actually found that adding these thickeners is advantageous for hiding if the ice crystals get too big. So as you have ice cream sitting in your freezer, the ice crystals actually grow over time. And this is bad because if they reach a certain size, we can feel them on our tongue. It's kind of like icy and grainy. But if you add these gums or thickeners, they actually can cover up that iciness. So in some studies, we've actually seen that they impact texture, but in a way where it's kind of like a good insurance plan if your ice crystals get too big.
Okay, that makes sense. Yep. What about, there's lots of people Maybe not in my age group anyway. They're always like, ice cream was so much better back in the day. And I don't know if that's actually true or you're just remembering what it was like as a kid and finally getting that sugar fix and then bouncing off the walls. But is there like a fundamental change in how we make ice cream, you know, over the last couple decades anyway? Obviously, you go back to the 50s, it's a completely different thing. But I mean,
I'm trying to think if there's, I can't think of anything particular. I just would say, because I see this from like things I ate as a kid or ate as a high schooler. It's like you always have this memory of like when you were like young or like in high school and you're like, this was the best thing ever. So I can't think of a reason that ice cream has been manufactured differently. And if anything, I feel like maybe now with like, you know, ice cream has to be shipped via like a cold chain. Like it gets very, its texture is impacted detrimentally if it gets like too warm and melts and then is refrozen. And I would guess today with like all the technology and tracking we have that honestly, maybe like the quality would be even a slightly higher just because it's not getting a lot of temperature abuse or that type of thing.
That makes sense. I guess there's like an actual testing regime to measure melting, right? To make this quantitative. It looks like they just basically put it on like a specially designed sieve and let it melt and then weigh how much at different times about what's left over. Is that kind of how it works?
No, this is entirely true. So I luckily did not have to do this for research, but a lot of my lab mates literally did watch like ice cream melt. So you always cut up like the same amount of ice cream and put it on top of a sieve, and then you just measure what melts through. It's literally called like a meltdown test, but you basically can look at the weight over time and, you know, calculate like how fast something melts or how fast the structure collapses. Because like I said, if you manipulate like the thickeners or the fat phase, that the water is still going to melt, but like the structure is so strong, it can just sort of hold that in that it wouldn't melt through the sieve.
Right. And I guess that's a standard sieve size as well.
Yes,
like the
yes,
openings no. And everything else, of course. Okay. So overall, the more liquid the behavior of like you're getting towards soft ice cream, it's got to be more than just temperature, right? Like there's something else to bring the nature of how it flows or its rheology, if you remember from the previous episode about volcanoes, that affects it. So what does that mean with respect to ice cream? Like how do we go from soft serve to hard serve? Is it just fats and stuff? Yeah,
so there's a couple ways you can manipulate it. One important one is actually how much sugar is in the ice cream. So the amount of sugar is really important because it impacts the freezing point depression. So basically, as you add more sugar, the freezing point gets lower. So it gives you a way to sort of control how much of the ice cream is actually freezing versus unfrozen. And so that would vary, that would like greatly impact. Is it more of like a soft ice cream versus something that like you can barely like scoop out of the, you know, out of the carton? There's other ways, like something like custard, like frozen custard. This texture is different just because it usually has more fat and usually egg yolks, where something like gelato, which is very like scoopable, is because it's held in that case at like a different temperature. So of course that's going to impact how much is melted and how much is not. So there's not, I wouldn't say there's just one way. Like soft serve, like you mentioned, it's made in a very specific freezer and then dispensed at like a not super cold temperature, which is why that is so soft. So we kind of have all these, you know, different tools or different methods to make. I mean, how many different ice cream products? Like there's so many different ones.
Yeah. Although with soft serve, I usually only see strawberry, chocolate, and vanilla. I've never seen like cotton candy soft serve or...
No, I agree. And I don't know if that is just tradition. Like I used to love when it was like twist. It was like half chocolate, half vanilla. But no, we really stick to those flavors. I'm not sure why.
Okay. I was curious about that. I was like, why is that?
The only thing I can think of is, You know the like little pieces of like cookie dough or chocolate chips in ice cream? We call those inclusions. So I think because of the type of freezer and then it's dispensed through a little nozzle, I don't think you can have those inclusions just because it's going to, clog the nozzle. But other than that, I think, yeah, I don't know why just we skipped to such basics.
So there's an option for the whack of whimsical ice cream is to have different flavors soft serve.
Absolutely. I mean, there's like a lot of white space in the market for that.
Apparently. don't worry, I'm not going to trademark it, any listeners. I'm sure you'll get to it before I do. What controls the like the rheology or the way the properties of flow and deformation with time in an ice cream? Like in magma, there's lots of different factors. And one of the biggest ones is actually chemically, where we take silicon and oxygen, they form chains, I guess, very similar to the way you're talking about that the fats forming chains, glooping up. Silicon and oxygen does that for magma, and it's usually the first factor. The higher the silicon, the higher the viscosity, the greater resistance to flow. Now, we've already talked about a bunch of these different properties with respect to ice cream, but is there like one which has more control than the rest? Is it temperature or is it...
So I would say you were onto it when you mentioned how like the fat is similar to what you studied. So specifically like the fat network is what I studied for my PhD. And what's interesting about ice cream is in like a lot of dairy products, even if there's the same amount of fat, they're just like these individual globules like floating around the water phase. But when we make ice cream, we put it in this special freezer. It's called a scraped surface freezer. So it literally has like a blade scraping the ice cream. And when it does this, it sort of makes those fat globules run into one another. And this is when they start to form that network. And depending, you know, if you can have like the same amount of fat, but if it's individual globules versus a network, this like really impacts the flow or that type of property of ice cream. Because like I said, it's this fat network, but there's kind of open spaces where there's maybe some of the like serum phase. It holds in different air bubbles so that you have a nice like scoopable fluffy ice cream. So this is why like studying this type of thing for research is interesting, because the fat is so important, but also where the fat is or how it's structured sort of dictates the properties of the ice cream. So one of the things I was really interested in was we were testing out like different fats to see which would form these like specialized fat networks we wanted, because ideally could you maybe make an ice cream with like a healthier fat. But the problem is you need a fat, like milk fat, that is part oil and part solid fat to get this fat network. Because otherwise, if it was all oil, it would just oil off, right? They would just all merge and make an oil layer. So what I was kind of looking into was like which fats would also make a very similar fat network in ice cream and therefore have a similar properties of traditional ice cream.
And I guess that has a big use for vegetarianism or veganism, right?
Yes, 100%. So a lot of times I was looking at things like palm oil, palm kernel oil, coconut oil. But the problem is milk fat is a bit specialized in, you know, what temperature does it start to solidify at? What temperature does it start to melt to oil? So you kind of want to match those properties, which isn't always possible with these other types of fats, is what makes it tricky.
Right. But couldn't you just then therefore modify the temperature at which you're at, or is that just too cold?
So you could during manufacture like manipulate the freezer temperature, but then the problem is like the freezers at home, you can't make them, you know, a different temperature. And so like the fat would become more liquid over time and it would ruin the structure, if that makes sense. So like we could do it during manufacturing because we have like super cold freezers and like hardening rooms, like we can really go to crazy low temperatures. But I think the problem would remain like even when the consumer took out the ice cream to scoop it, like just that temperature change would be it might be enough to ruin things.
So there was no fat found of any sort that would get you close.
No, you can definitely get close and you'll see those fats in ice cream, but you usually can tell, like if you pay attention, you might be able to taste the difference or like see a texture difference. But oftentimes, you know, if you're someone who is vegan or vegetarian, that's sort of the sacrifice you're willing to make, right? You're obviously, it's not going to be identical to, you know, products that contain meat and dairy. So you sort of have to pick your poison, I guess.
Yeah, for sure. And I guess the fat levels and the different types of fat and how much sugar, it all links into how we enjoy the ice cream, how it tastes, right?
Yes, absolutely. So fat, like I always am like, oh, fat tastes so good. So if something tastes like creamy to you or creamy in your mouth, that is fat, or that is fat and oils that gives you that sensation. And so if you have like a low fat product or no fat product, you will notice it's not quite the same mouthfeel. And unfortunately, we it's really hard to duplicate, you know, that creaminess without, you know, so much fat or oils. And I would also say with sugar, again, of course you're adding sugar because ice cream is sweet, right? It's for the taste. But also, like I said, the sugar content sort of dictates the freezing point. So actually, it also dictates like, is it scoopable or is it frozen as a rock? You know, it also dictates texture in that way.
So what's the sweet
spot? It really depends. So it depends on your manufacturing equipment, like how cold can your freezer go, that you will want to change like your formulation, how much sugar or how much fat. And also for like the fat levels, there is actually... some foods have a standard of identity, it's called. It's basically like a legal definition. Like if you are selling premium ice cream, it must have this, this, and this. So for ice cream, fat level is really important because, yeah, the more fat, like typically the better it tastes or feels. So we have like standard ice cream has a lower amount of fat, but a premium ice cream has more fat in it. But you'll also notice these tend to be more expensive because the fat is an expensive ingredient. So if you go to the store now and look at ice cream labels, you might see like standard, premium, super premium. But that is really referring to a fat level.
I always thought that was referring to an air level, like how much air bubbles are in it.
Oh, no, but that brings up a good point. So we haven't really talked about the air bubbles. So controlling the air, we call this overrun, or the percent of air injected into the ice cream during manufacture. What I will say about air that is very interesting is if you lift like Halo Top, like the low calorie, or like one brand is called Halo Top, but they're basically like a low calorie ice cream. Like you can eat the whole pint and it's only 300 calories or something. So they, if you pick up a pint of that and a pint of like Häagen-Dazs, which is like five ingredients, like really high quality ice cream, the Häagen-Dazs is going to be way heavier than the low calorie one. And one of the reasons is because air is calorie free. So the, you know, like if you're eating low calorie ice cream, you actually just paid for like a lot of air.
Okay. So, but what about, I don't know why, where I heard this and this, I did not remember this until you just mentioned about premium versus low quality ice cream, but those four, I guess they're a gallon tub in the States. For me, it's a 4-liter tub. And I always got told that it has way more air and that's why it's so much cheaper. I don't know if that's true.
No, I would confirm this. So I agree. I that was the ice cream we always got as kids. It's in like a big clear like plastic circle, like like a gallon we would get. And it is, if you look at the price, it is way cheaper. That also has a lot of air. Yes.
What I was told was at least somewhat true.
Yes. Yes.
More complicated, but it's still true. Okay. Yes. It's also probably lower in quality fat.
I would say the ingredients are probably lower quality, but also the quantity of air. They put in max air because you're just filling the volume of that gallon, right? You just got fill it up and then, with, you know, the lowest price point you can.
Right. But it did make it kind of fluffy. So I guess filling it up with air doesn't necessarily ruin the experience.
No. I think it all depends what you prefer, because adding more air does make it fluffy. Like the air cells breaking up the rest of the structure is what it's like whipping, right? Like whipped cream, right? That's what makes it more like soft and fluffy. So I'm not saying it's worse. There's probably people where that's like their favorite texture of ice cream. And for them, that's great because they're saving a lot of money.
So there's lots of other things that we haven't covered so far. And I think they probably all have similar issue or effects on the ice cream. So we've kind of already talked about fats, but one of the ones that I don't really understand very well, because I don't understand it at all, is emulsifiers. That just makes it more structurally sound, question mark?
Yes, let me explain this. Yes. this is like one of the more complicated ones to explain. So I understand. It comes back to the fat network, which I told you earlier, we want to form, like we want them to partially merge. So the reason that you'll see nowadays a lot of ice cream has emulsifiers added, if you look at the ingredient statement, that's like monodiglycerides, egg yolks, lecithin, those are emulsifiers. And we simply add these molecules because they go to the surface of the fat globules. They sort of absorb there and they make the fat globules more prone to partially merging. They make it easier for those fat globules, if they run into each other, they're more likely to form this fat network, which, like I said, is really, really important in the structure of ice cream, or to make like an ice cream that doesn't collapse very quickly. And so especially nowadays where like ice cream might, you know, sit in our freezer for a long time, it needs to be really stable. You'll see these types of emulsifier ingredients added.
Okay. That makes sense. Yeah. Things tend to sit in my freezer for a long time, especially if it's not summer. Like if it's not summer, the ice cream sits there for months.
No.
I guess the emulsifiers are the reason why it still tastes not rock hard solid.
Yes, no, they help.
Bending
they...
spoons and stuff. Okay, but all of that kind of we've talked about them, but we've kind of skipped over ice crystals to some extent, other than they're there. Ice is part of ice cream. It's in the name. So I assume they're still always there and they're always required.
Yes. So ice crystals, it is kind of funny. We didn't get to ice crystals until later when it's like, we're talking about ice cream. No, yeah. Ice crystals. So ice crystals are really, really important to control. And so when we manufacture ice cream, like in that scrape surface freezer, another reason that blade goes around.
Hang on a second. Scrape surface freezer is not, I should have picked up on this before. I have no idea what you're talking about.
Oh, yes. Okay. It's just a special type of freezer. It's kind of like a long barrel and you put the ice cream mix in it, which is a liquid when you start. And then you freeze it while like a blade is going around and scraping it off the barrel. So everything is always moving, like always being scraped off the freezer. And you do that until you reach a certain temperature. So that's called a scraped surface freezer. It's just like a special freezer used for ice cream products. And like I said, that was important to make the fat network because it gets like all the globules moving and, running into each other. But another reason you always want that blade going around, or we call it a dasher sometimes, is because you want to keep the ice crystals as small as possible. So the blade sort of mixes everything so that the crystals can't grow bigger and bigger. They're sort of disrupted before they get too big. And so ideally, when you manufacture ice cream, you try to make extremely small crystals because they only grow over time. And especially if someone like you keeps your ice cream in your freezer, the ice crystals only get bigger. That is the only way they're going to move, so that the quality can only go down. So you want to start with crystals as small as possible. And that's only because our tongue doesn't detect the crystals at a certain level, where if they grow over time in your freezer or at the grocery store or whatever, eventually the texture is negatively impacted. And so it tastes more like coarse or icy in our mouth. And that's because, so I don't know if you know this, but like our freezers at home, they actually temperature cycle. It's not always the same temperature. And what happens to the ice crystals is, of course, when your freezer warms up, some of them melt. And when they melt, what happens is the big crystals will grow at the expense of the small crystals. So basically, the melted water only makes bigger crystals grow and the small ones leave, which, like I said, makes a very bad texture for when you eat the ice cream.
Right. Well, here's a really nerdy question. Mm-hmm. Diffusion.
Yes.
Is that part of adding the fat, is to reduce how the water can travel through and create bigger crystals?
No, that is definitely helpful. So like the fat can absolutely disrupt diffusion. Also the thickeners, so like the hydrocolloids or gums, these are sort of really long molecules where they can grab free water and kind of bind it, which means the water can't diffuse to build to the water crystal. So like when I'm working with a client and formulating an ice cream, a lot of them say want to get rid of the thickeners because they want a shorter ingredient statement. But I always tell them, like, these gums or thickeners are your insurance plan, right? Because your ice cream, somewhere along the shipping, the grocery store, the consumer, is going to be temperature abused. And if you want a consistently good texture, you want to add these types of molecules to sort of grab and bind that water.
Okay, so that is, okay, first off, diffusion, for those who are following along and don't really know what that means, it's the process of chemicals or elements traveling across something without force. They just kind of diffuse. It's a bit like quantum mechanics in some respects, but they travel like capillary action through to where they want to bind and form different things, in this case, crystals. I guess what you're describing, though, is a bit of trying to, that to and fro between kitchen chemistry and like the requirements of a modern world with world supply chains and stuff.
Yes, absolutely. And a lot of people will say, well, like, I make it in my kitchen with 5 ingredients, and that's great, but you also don't have to ship it anywhere. It doesn't sit in a warehouse. You probably eat it a lot faster. Maybe you made like a small batch, you ate it in like 5 days, whereas something you buy at the grocery store, at least I would say Americans keep food for a long time in their cabinets, in their fridge, in their freezer. And so, you know, as the food company, you don't want the consumer to have a bad experience. So you try to formulate the food to be, you know, good for an extremely long time now.
Right. That must be frustrating, or at least awkward on your part when you're dealing with clients, though, right? Like, that's where you get to use your knowledge and be like, yes, okay, who's the end user here? Is this like a small little mom and pop ice creamery where you're producing it and serving it within a week, mm-hmm, or is this like shipping across the country?
Yes. And I feel like, you know, in so many aspects of our life, we sort of understand there is science behind it. But I think because no one knows about food science, sometimes people innately get upset if you say like there's science behind food, because they are like, no, food is natural and we just have it, you know, why are you like messing with our food? And it's like, no, there, you could not even comprehend, like, humans have been using science to create different foods and breed foods since humans existed. But it's kind of this weird disconnect sometimes.
Yeah, I can totally see that. It's one of those things that everyone has that you know, experience with cooking in their kitchen and stuff. So they also see themselves as kind of like this expert. Mm-hmm. But yet, once you step outside the kitchen to a different realm, it really starts to change quite drastically. So I think we kind of covered everything that I wanted to cover, and at least I think I understand it. I still haven't quite in my head been able to piece each of them into like structure into my head, like the structure of ice cream. We've got all these different pieces, but I'm having a hard time in my 3D brain visualizing, mm-hmm, how that structure comes together. Do you have anything that can help me?
Let me try to describe it. Okay, the first level, let's just have it's like the unfrozen serum phase. It's the watery phase, what doesn't freeze. And that's holding some molecules like the salts, the lactose, and whey proteins. Now, on top of that layer, can you put like the fat network, like all these millions of globules kind of partially merged, but there's like open spaces, right? It's not like one big network. It's kind of branchy. It kind of goes here and there. And so that's sitting inside of that unfrozen serum phase. So put that inside. And then kind of inside the free spaces of the fat network is the air bubbles. That's where we whipped in air bubbles or air cells. And the fat network kind of holds those in, kind of surrounds it. So that's how I kind of think of it in my brain. I don't know if that's helpful to you, but that's how I sort of like layer it, you know, like what holds in what.
Yeah, no, that makes perfect sense to me. Thank you for that. Now I actually have a 3D picture in my brain.
Yes.
It helps, I guess, maybe that I do geology and think in 3D.
Good.
But the layering definitely helps. But now we're going to complicate it even further with inclusions. I mean, flavors.
Yes.
Only so much time in one episode, but I couldn't leave it without at least bringing them in. So how does flavor like mess with all of what you just said?
Yeah. So flavor in honestly every food is one of those tricky aspects because flavor molecules are very sensitive. And so usually in most foods, you add them right at the end. Like everything gets processed, is manufactured, and then you add the flavor because flavor will degrade with heat, with different temperatures, if exposed to oxygen. It's just one of those chemicals that they're very sensitive. So you want to do it the last thing and then quick, like package it up. The one thing that I always notice that people seem to misunderstand about flavor is that they think taste and flavor is the same thing, and they're not. So flavor encompasses taste, but actually what really dictates the flavor of food is our nose. So those flavor molecules have to get to our nose and we smell them, and that's really what makes food enjoyable. And you know this if you've ever had like a cold and you have a stuffy nose and you're like, oh, I'm not hungry, like I just, food doesn't taste right. You are still tasting it on your tongue, of course. Your taste buds are working. The problem is you can't smell. And so flavor, I'd like to say, is a mix of like taste, smell. Actually, one other important thing in flavor is we have pain receptors in our mouth. And that also leads to flavor. Like spicy food triggers these pain receptors. I love like carbonated water, like that sort of bubbly, fizzy feeling is triggering those receptors. So flavor, like I said, super finicky to work with, but really, really important to get right because us humans love like a good flavor.
Yeah, for sure. I've heard people tell me that you should add the garlic right at the end of stuff, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
My own experience in the kitchen, depending what you're using, sometimes you want to cook it a while because it's too strong otherwise.
But absolutely. True. But see, you're manipulating the flavor. That's why I
exactly.
said they're sensitive. So if you add heat, you're going to lose some of them. Exactly.
Yeah. And you won't cause those pain receptors to go too yep. crazy in
no.
your mouth.
No.
Okay. So from flavor, what is the weirdest ice cream flavor you've ever helped create or witness yourself?
Yes. So this one I did not create, and I don't know if I would want to take responsibility for it anyways. But
oh, so you're telling me you might be lying now.
No. It just wasn't. It was the most interesting one I've ever had. It was mustard custard, like frozen custard. And I live in Wisconsin, and in Wisconsin, we have the like the world's mustard museum, or like the US's mustard museum. And so there was a festival in this town where the mustard museum is. So they did a collaboration with a frozen custard shop and served mustard custard. And of course I had to try it, and I'm glad I tried it, but I just needed one bite and then I was good, I will say.
You got the smallest size available.
Yes.
Did you
I
see
just,
anybody?
Like, one spoon.
Did you see anybody with like a double scoop?
No. I think everyone had the same thoughts I did, and it was like, this was fun, but this is enough.
That's funny. I was going to spend this part to try to like summarize the different parts. The first part, I think I can do that. The difference between soft ice cream and hard ice cream seems to be a combination of mostly sugar and temperature. Is that
yes.
kind of correct?
Yes, I like that a lot. I think that will be good.
Yeah. So In other words, generally speaking, your soft serve ice cream has got more sugar.
Mm-hmm.
Oh. See, that was so easy. I was expecting that to be more complicated.
Well, also, soft serve, like I said, is dispensed at just warmer temperature.
Yeah.
Like in that soft serve freezer that is used.
From your local McDonald's or mm-hmm. whatever. Summing up, the changing in how it feels in your mouth is based on structure, so therefore mostly the fat network.
You could say fat. You could also say ice crystal size.
Okay.
Just because if, like I said, they're going to grow and eventually you will feel them.
Right. So if I was going to make a whimsical whack of ice cream, I would want to keep the ice crystals small.
Exactly.
And yes. I guess I'm going to go with, because there's more area on the market for a soft serve flavor. So
mm-hmm.
that seems to be the way I would go.
No, I agree.
But it isn't all about screaming for ice cream. I mean, you're also a science communicator, too. You have a YouTube channel that gets into food science and other parts of the industry, I guess. What brought you into YouTube and being a science communicator?
Yeah, this was just a fun project I started during my PhD because when I was writing my dissertation, which is the worst part, I would argue, COVID actually happened. So then I was writing my dissertation alone in my like one bedroom apartment, not seeing anyone ever. So that is when I started my YouTube channel because I just needed something to like creatively do. And I love food science and I love teaching it. So I just started, you know, it's just like Abby the food scientist and explains, you know, like there are so many things you see in your kitchen or something like why, like when you fry an egg, why can you make an over easy egg where the yolk is runny, but the whites are cooked? It's like things you know, but you didn't know there are science behind it. So I just started making all these fun videos to show people like, hey, there's food science. Like there are people who are food scientists. And it's super fun. I actually just maybe a month ago, I launched my first coloring book. So it's a candy science coloring book available on Amazon. So I studied ice cream, but the lab I worked in was like a confectionery frozen dessert lab. So I love, especially with kids, like if someone would have told me like your favorite candy is science behind it, I would have been sold.
Yeah. I think just pass me along the links and I'll make sure those get in there. I'm sure it's on the Canadian Amazon as well. If not, the link to the US one will be there.
Yes,
you can still
sure.
get it. May not be tariff free. Sorry. anything else that we skipped as part of like the ice cream science story?
No, I feel like you did a really good job. Like we talked about all the most important stuff for sure.
Awesome. Well, I guess then it's on to the last traditional question here on Whimsical Wavelengths, where you tell us a science joke, and hopefully your favorite.
Yes, no, this one, I hope it hasn't been used already, but this one always cracks me up. So it's like, two guys walk into a bar, and one says to the bartender, "I'll have some H2O," and the other one goes, "I'll have some H2O2," and he dies.
And you know what? We're not even going to explain that joke. Actually, no one has used it yet.
Okay.
So, well, thank you so much for being here. And
thank you so much. It's been very fun.
And that ties up episode 2 in season 2. I hope you enjoyed it. In fact, I'm hoping you'll leave me a review, a written review on Apple Podcasts or a rating on any other podcast app you're grabbing this from, because those really do matter. Send me a line on social media. Help amplify the message. And just ask me questions. Give me show ideas. And I'll see you in 2 weeks. And in 2 weeks' time, we're going to be looking at the accretionary disks of black holes. Yeah. Season 2 is already off to an amazing start. I'll see you guys next time.
In a world so chaotic, so misbehaved, echoes of melodies remind us it's always colors, weave stories painting the sky. swaying to rhythms as the galaxies fly by.